All right, and this is part two of our top stories of 2015 in the sort of, I guess, alternative fringe realm. And again, I'm here with Joshua Cutchin, Michael Hughes, and Red Pill Junkie. Everyone doing all right?
Doing great.
All right, so one of the things that happened in 2015, oddly enough, is people died. We lost Leonard Nimoy.
That was the one that got me. I think I posted on Twitter the other day that if an asteroid collided with the Earth and wiped out everything, I'm happy that at least Star Trek came out of human beings. You know, I mean, that show just really, it's kind of like, you know, everything I needed to know I learned in kindergarten. Well, everything I needed to know I learned from Star Trek. It really shaped my consciousness and who I am. And the key to all of it, of course, was Spock. You know, I mean, who could not love Spock as just an iconic character, in so many ways, and so telling about the human condition and our the problems we have with balancing logic and emotion and things like that. And he was just a stand up guy too. I mean, just a phenomenal human being. And that one hurt. I mean, I actually shed tears when Nimoy died. It's very rare that I get that emotional about the passing of someone in the entertainment world, but that was a big loss.
Yeah. Well, he did write that great song about the Hobbit.
Bilbo, right. Bilbo.
And In Search Of, you know, I've recently
In Search Of. Yeah.
I've been watching In Search Of's, and I'm telling you, if you can find them and watch them, man, they really still hold up. There was a great one I watched a few nights ago. It was basically about ESP and children, and Nimoy was sitting around with like Zener ESP cards and a table full of kids and getting these kids to sort of guess which card he was looking at out of all those symbols. And it was great. I mean, that was the beauty of the set, being a kid in the 70s, is this stuff was taken seriously. It was approached seriously. You know, it didn't have the ridiculousness of stuff like Ancient Aliens or whatever, you know, that takes an interesting topic, but just, you know, craps all over it. And you know, it was an era where you could discuss things like that without, you know, people smirking or In Search Of, I don't know about you guys, but that was a key, that was like a the cornerstone of my whole Fortean development. Was In Search Of. I mean, that was such a big show for so many people, I think.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
You can actually get it on Amazon now. They've re-released it on DVD in a box set for $45.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Nice. Yeah.
Originally it was 150. Now it's 45.
Oh. Nice. Yeah, it's one of those things that I didn't really realize until like maybe the past year or so, hearing people talk about his passing. But the In Search Of specifically influenced so many people in this area, and I feel like it's one of those things where he could have done that, or he could have done, you know, Star Trek, you know, or he could have directed 3 Men and a Baby, and any of those one things would have put him, into a spot in history. But for him to have done, you know, to have this giant body of work is so cool.
Yeah,
and he also
did
Fringe, which was fantastic as far as like the paranormal, odd type of stuff goes.
Oh, I didn't know he was involved with that. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, he was a big part of it, but he wasn't in it very much.
Okay. Mm.
So, Mike, what do you think of all these people? Have you read Chris Nowell's Secret Song blog?
Oh, all the time.
Okay, so what do you think of his opinion that Star Trek is actually like a veiled way to promote or to make a propaganda about this military type New World Order?
Yeah, I I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. But to me, you know, knowing the roots of Star Trek and like the Council of Nine and all that, are you guys familiar with all that stuff? That Roddenberry was part of a group of people that like gathered around these this channelers and things. And, you know, so there's really a deep esoteric element behind Roddenberry.
Sorry to burst your bubble about that because
burst my bubble, damn it.
You know who Dan Mattson is?
Yeah, I do.
Dan Mattson is the originator of the first Star Trek fan magazine. Right.
Okay.
And then after that, he created the Star Wars fan magazine and Lord of the Rings. So this guy, I met him first at the first Paradigm Symposium in 2012. I mean, it was one of the best presentations that they had in that whole conference. Let me tell you. And he told that he became good friends with Gene Roddenberry and also with Leonard Nimoy and Shatner, all these guys. So I took the opportunity to, as a fan of Chris and his blog, to ask the question, ask him. You know, I told him about this story of the Group of Nine, of story that Roddenberry was somehow in contact through a channeler with these alien intelligences. And according to him, a man who knew Roddenberry, who was a good friend of him, there was nothing to the story. Although he told me that Roddenberry was, in fact, very interested in the UFO phenomenon. So, I don't know. That, right?
That's because he hid all of his secrets on these 200 floppy disks. You heard about that?
Yeah, exactly.
Came out.
Yep. And just more pop culture, we lost Roddy Piper.
Oh, yes, they live, man.
So, I forgot about that connection. I always just associate him with wrestling. I forget that he actually had a part in some decent movies, too, sometimes.
Yeah, they live is definitely one movie that should be at the top 10 of all the people who are interested in the Forgeon realm.
And he was an interesting guy, too, and he definitely put wrestling on the map. Without him, Hulk Hogan never would have hit the heights he did. I mean, he was the perfect bad guy for Hogan to fight up against and put wrestling in that spotlight it had in the 1980s. So we lost Lemmy.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh yeah,
recently.
Did you hear that people are starting to call rum and cokes Lemmies now in honor of him? I like that trend.
The fact that he was doing what he did till pretty much his dying day.
I'm sorry, Jack and Cokes. That's a big faux pas there. Okay, yeah, Jack and Cokes, sorry.
But I mean, at 70 years old, he smoked heavily, he drank heavily, he pretty much partied nonstop and made it to 70. You know, he was the true rock and roll lifestyle, and he influenced a lot of people. But back on to more of the paranormal level, we have Boyd Bushman's deathbed confession.
Oh, yes.
You want to get a little into that, Red Pill?
Well, apparently Boyd Bushman was someone who was involved in the alleged reverse engineering of crashed flying saucers and how they tried to reverse engineer their propulsion systems. But it's such a bizarre, ambiguous story because on the one hand, the guy seemed to have had the right credentials, right? So he was a scientist. He was someone who did look into radical propulsion systems. You know, he walked the walk in that regard. You know, he was involved in secret black budget programs. But with this deathbed confession and how he showed these alleged photos of aliens that apparently someone gave to him, which were, in my humble opinion, so ridiculous, you know, so fake. It was something of a head scratcher to me, like something that further convinced me or makes me suspect that there's some kind of safe, secure mechanism with all these potential whistleblowers that they feed them this first with some kind of story or of disinformation that is so preposterous, so easy to dismiss, or so easy to debunk that somehow prevents them to be taken seriously, you know, mm-hmm, afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you know that specific set of photos, I mean, you can find within a minute and a half on a Google search a picture of the doll that looks exactly like, I mean, down to the coloration, everything, the reported photos. And yeah, it definitely seems like there's a deliberate effort to undermine the credibility of folks like this. The question is why they went along with it. I don't know if you had just gotten old and, you know, pardon me saying this, senile, or do we know when he was given those photos?
Not to my knowledge.
I feel like it was long enough. Well, I don't know. If it had, yeah. I just it's interesting because it's why someone would go along with that. I don't know. I mean, maybe. Oh, well, there. Sometimes I wonder, and I have before, that maybe there is not only deliberate obfuscation, but perhaps they're the phenomena. You know, somehow goes out of its way to make people seem less credible.
It reminds me of something that I heard in one of Christopher Ryan's, you know, podcasts. He has a podcast called Tangentially Speaking, and he he mentioned this on his later Shrimp Parade podcast with Joe Rogan and Duncan Trussell. How he has a friend of his who is like into magic, right? You know, sleight of hand kind of tricks. Mm-hmm. And he's told that his friend will show him a particular trick, and he will do it over and over and over again. You know, he won't tell him what the trick was. You know, he will just show it as many times as he would like, and Chris will never figure it out. You know, he will never figure out what was the trick or how he managed to fool him. And after a while, his friend will tell him, don't worry, Chris. The smartest people are the easier to fool. You know?
Yeah.
magicians, he told this guy to Chris, magicians are always afraid of dumb people and children.
Exactly. Those are the
kind of people or the kinds of individuals who will always look in the wrong places, where the magicians were not willing or expecting them to look.
Yeah, there's so maybe. I've been a magician. And that is exactly true. And
that's fascinating.
That's why I've met William. What's his name? His last name's Brody or something like that. I think he's a parapsychologist. I met him at a Fortean conference once, and he had done. He wrote a book about a woman that would produce like gold flakes or something. I think he called her
the
gold dust woman or something. And he was there giving his talk, and as a magician, as a mentalist. You know, he showed a video of this woman producing this gold stuff. And, you know, while it was very interesting, I could see just from the couple of short clips that he showed several ways where this woman could have been, you know, surreptitiously producing this stuff.
Now and you're busting my bubble.
Yeah. Well, what happened is I didn't get much chance to talk with him, but I talked to George Hansen, And I asked her a chance, and I said, you know, I said, is he, I think his name's Brody, and I'm sorry if I'm getting it wrong, but I think it's Brody. And I said, does he ever take, you know, because George Hansen is a magician as well. And I said, you know, George, does he ever take a magician with him on these things? He's like, no, he doesn't. And, and you know, I mean, that should be ground rule number one when you're investigating someone who has claims of, you know, any kind of psychic or paranormal ability, is you have to have a magician. Because,
yeah,
and I think I told you when the show we did, just me and you, Soraya, is that, you know, I did a mentalism demonstration once for a Fortean conference, and I had people come about, and I told them, I said, I'm going to show you how this is going to be trickery, and I'm going to, this is how people do trickery and pretend to be psychic. And I did my routine, and afterward people were coming up to me and saying, that was not trickery. There's no way that could have been a trick. After I insisted, told them what I'm doing is trickery. This is the whole point of what I'm doing. I had three people come up to me afterwards and they said, there's absolutely, you are truly psychic. And there's no way, you know, and they would not believe me. And so that, you know, that was a very big lesson for me. So, you know, if I hear of an investigation as something like that, and there's no trained mentalist or magician going along, then it loses all credibility for me. Yeah. And it's exactly for that reason, is because the smartest people, the people who think I'm a scientist, there's absolutely no way you could fool me. Well, yeah, I can fool you easier than I could fool a 3-year-old kid, because that 3-year-old kid is going to be looking in a completely different direction than you are while I'm doing this stuff. So absolutely, I agree 100% with that.
Okay. All right. I forgot where we started with this. Oh, it was the photos and stuff.
Yeah, the boy pushing
thing. Oh yeah, yeah.
In a way, it's a modern parallel with the Arthur Conan Doyle, you know, and the Cottingley fairies.
Yeah. The fairies, right? Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
But the thing about the Bushman story is that you hear this from so many whistleblowers, and the story of, you know, the government having these craft and being back engineered and stuff are similar. They're not always, they're not the same story, but they're very similar stories.
Yes.
And the people telling them seem genuine, seem to believe them.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's part of what the government is trying to do, is to create this impression to steer people the wrong way. Because if they didn't want these people talking, these people wouldn't be talking.
Yeah, yes. That's true, but you know, at the same time, I mean, let's look at the Canadian guy who
Paul Hellyer.
What's his name? Yeah. And you know, it's like whenever someone, you know, allegedly blows the whistle, or even as far back as Philip Corso, you know, whenever there's a whistleblower out there, there's always one element that, or more than one element in the case of Heller, I guess, that just completely destroys all credibility. You know, yeah. I mean, there's always an element to their story that I just completely can't accept. So are they doing this intentionally? Are they fed material that's inaccurate to destroy their credibility? Or are they doing, you know, is it intentional? Or are they being duped?
Mind control?
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. What's going on?
Good disinformation.
Yeah.
You know, add to that ridicule factor that surrounds UFOs. Oh, look at what these people are saying. They're clearly crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
And also the fact that the phenomenon itself is deceptive in nature, you know?
Right,
so
right.
Sure.
Triple whammy.
Mm-hmm. But it always seems to me that the whistleblowers are always very much in the extraterrestrial camp, right?
Yes.
Yes.
So, you know, if, as some of us suspect, you know, Nick Redfern, you know, with his the group he was talking about that are convinced that they're demonic or, you know, discarnate kind of things that are tweaking us, well, you know, that would be a great way if, you know, if you wanted to keep that under wraps, is to put these guys out there with this, you know, these extraterrestrial stories that then, you know, are seeded with stuff that immediately makes it all fall apart. You know, I'm not sure if that makes sense.
Well, it does, because I think what happens is the people who want to believe figure there's some element of truth in that story.
Right, right. And
the people who don't go, well, look at this ridiculous story. See, UFOs are all nonsense.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to the MJ-12 thing. You know, there's probably just enough facts in MJ-12 that make it seem credible, but there's enough bunk that it makes it, you know, get written off.
Right, right. That's the key to disinformation, you know? I mean, it's the classic. You throw some real stuff in there and then throw some absolute bunk.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody's just scratching their heads.
Yeah, like the well-manicured guy in the X-Files. He said the best place to hide the truth is between two lies.
Yeah. I just say don't listen to anything that comes out of the supposed government as far as UFOs go.
What's that Chris O'Brien quote, once a spook, always spooky?
Yeah. let's see. Other losses this year. We had Walter Andrus, who was the MUFON founder.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of people are pretty anti-MUFON at this point, not liking what they've become, but they've been important over the history of UFOs.
I will jump
absolutely
in. Did I speak at all about my interaction with MUFON with anybody here?
I don't know.
I had the opportunity to speak with the Atlanta chat, with the Georgia chapters rather, annual meeting back on the 13th of December, and it was the most refreshing, exciting group of people that I could have hoped to have spoken with.
Awesome.
Very much open to altered states of consciousness ideas. Very much open to different ideas. You know, I came in there and I'm talking about fairies and aliens and Sasquatch. And they were, and for the most part, everybody was on board. There were one or two people who were still stuck in the ETH, but everybody was very much like, this could be any number of things, and it's probably a lot of things. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
And I had some coffee with the state director afterwards, and he says, if we get the hint that anybody is out there trying to prove that every case is little green men, little green scientists from, you know, Zeta Reticuli, then we wouldn't let them go out and represent us. And he said, I don't know what's going on, but the answer is not entirely space doctors. I'm like, wow, this is so. Yeah, I'll because, you know, I was sort of move on. You know, there's so much that you could be doing, but that really it was very encouraging seeing it all going in the right direction. I have a lot more faith in the organization than I did, you know, a year ago.
Can I ask you something?
Yes.
Can you kind of tell us what was the age average of the audience?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a good question. Mid-40s. There are a couple of people that I would say are in their 30s. Gender diversity, about probably, I'd say, 70-30 men. So not, okay, you know, still a boys club. The racial diversity was kind of surprising. It was obviously you know, probably about 70%, you know, Caucasian, but there was a solid, I would say, 25%, 25% African American base there, which I found sort of surprising. And then a 5%, you know, mixed other Asian, et cetera. Which, you know, I thought those were interesting demographics that I wouldn't expect, given, you know, the old white guy is who we always think of being involved in ufology. So it was really encouraging to see that much diversity there and to see that much open-mindedness. It was a really cool experience.
Awesome.
It is a graying demographic, though, I have to say. I mean,
yeah,
I go to these conferences, it's we're all kind of on our way to, you know, dinosaurdom. And there's not a lot of fresh, you know, young people in these, at least at the conferences, you know. Maybe because young people are just more online. You know, that's how they interact. But that's a sad fact when it comes to MUFON or, you know, any of these other organizations. You know, I'm a member of INFO, the International Fortean Organization, and I used to help out with their conferences, and I've done a couple talks at the conferences things. And man, it's you know, I'm the young guy there. You know, I mean, it's you know.
Let me ask you guys this: do you think that 15 years from now there will still be large UFO organizations like MUFON?
I
don't know.
I would like to see it be more of a, as opposed to being like this sort of quasi-united front. I would like to see it almost like a confederation of independent state organizations, and within that, you know, a certain level of autonomy at a regional level within certain states. I think that might be a good way to handle the whole situation, because every time you get an organization too big like that, it's going to have some of the problems that you get with having an organization that large. Whether or not that means that will happen or not, I don't know. But I kind of get the sense that that might be the direction it's going in.
I'm also wondering, as more and more people are realizing all this phenomena may be connected, that we'll see less UFO-specific groups and more open research groups, you know, aren't just focused on one aspect of this phenomena.
Mm. Yeah, and I would also say that I think that I get the impression from some people I've talked to that there is some good stuff happening with the folks who are what's the guy who's the Miami attorney who had a moment of Ray Hernandez.
Oh, yeah.
Free, F-R-E-E. I feel like they're doing some interesting stuff kind of along those lines.
Hmm. And another person we lost that I think meant a lot to Red Pill was Bruce Dwensing.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I've never spoken or interacted with him, but I listened to that interview that he had with my friend Greg Bishop in Radio Misterioso not long before he passed away. And I remember listening the first time and really not in understanding a thing that these guys were saying, you know. Like, it was kind of like rushing above my head, you
yeah,
know, going
yeah.
way above my way of thinking, and saying, well, let me give it a second time, and finding all this richness in trying to follow the way of thinking of this of this guy. And I agree with Greg, and then Greg and I and Robert had this like little homage at Radio Misterioso, trying to give our respects and trying to express what Bruce had given us in way of trying to, like, I don't know, encourage us or coax us to leave our normal comfort zone with regards to trying to understand the UFO phenomenon, which is, I guess, some of the things in which MUFON has fallen into, you know, that they have tried to investigate the phenomenon from a comfort zone. And I think that the UFO phenomenon is the opposite, you know. It's like shaking your belief system, shaking your sense of reality, and showing you that there is a whole bigger world out there that you have no comprehension of. And that the first step is admitting that, like Robert Anton Wilson said, you know, the first thing is, if you think you're what's going on, you don't know shit. Right?
Exactly.
You're probably full of shit. And yeah. And Bruce, I think, is what was one of the persons who understood the complexity of the UFO phenomenon kind of like try to tackle it from that level of complexity, which made him a bit inscrutable for the rest of us. But, you know, there's something about trying to use different forms of rationality in order to find new insights into the phenomenon, right? And another thing that happened was that Bruce wrote one last blog post in his personal blog, which felt quite prescient, almost like he kind of sensed that his passing was kind of nearby, you know, and that really touched Greg and Robert and me, and you know, we tried to pay homage to him and his hopes to understand the phenomenon as best we could on that little Radio Misterioso program. Mm.
Hmm. And those are still available on Radio Misterioso, right?
Yeah. And let me add that Greg is in contact with, or was in contact with, Bruce's daughter. And the last I heard, they were very much in agreement of trying to write a book about Bruce, you know, with not unlike what Paul Kimball did with the late McTonis and his
right. Mm-hmm.
And posthuman blues blog. And I think that would be a good thing, because one of the things I remember we said is that maybe the best homage that we could give to Bruce was that trying to promote his ideas, so that maybe 20 years from now, you know, some kid will find his blog or will read his book and will have his mind blown, you know, and maybe, you know, that kid then will completely alter his perspective on life and change completely, you know, 180 degrees his life journey, you know, and that in itself would be, you know, quite an achievement and quite a legacy to Bruce and to anyone, you know, if this what we're doing right now, we guys are talking, but Soraya will later, you know, release this podcast, and think about you know, to think that maybe 10, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, someone manages to listen to this MP3 and, you know, change their perspective, if only for a little mm-hmm. while, you know, in only alter their views of the UFO phenomenon or other Fortean phenomena just a little, you know, nudge them just a little in trying to look into the mystery. That for me will be enough, you know. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean. That for me should that mean that would mean that this wasn't, you know, a complete waste of time.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go. Let's move into Dressgate.
I love this.
So do I, and a lot of people were just annoyed by it, but I don't think people really understood the consequences of what they were experiencing. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is the dress that people either saw as what were the colors?
White, or what was it? Blue and gold.
White and yellow. Yeah. White and gold and blue and black, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And I, the first time I heard anything about it, I kind of ignored it for a bit, and then I looked at it, and I was like, "Oh, it's whatever color." And then, you know, I looked at it for a bit, and I went, "All right." And I left the room, and I came back, and it was a different color. And I went, all right, what's the trick? And I downloaded the image, made sure it wasn't a GIF. I'm like, all right, how could they have made this change? Because it completely looks different. Mm-hmm. And on my music show, I had pulled it up to the groans of a few people on the show. And I said, what color's the dress? And everyone looking at the same dress, a few people had different colors.
Mm.
So it wasn't a trick of the light of the room or anything like that. They were looking at it and going, oh, it's this. And then someone else is like, seriously, it's this. And it's like, and that's what's interesting about it, because it tells you how unreliable your perceptions really are.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to be a Grinch here. I'm sorry. You know, I think Red Pill threw a monkey wrench into my Star Trek Council of the Nine theory earlier. But to me, I mean, I've been a graphic designer, you know, for the early part of my professional life. And to me, it was clearly, you know, it was clearly a matter of it was a white dress. I mean, it was a white dress. And it was the fact that something in the way that it was photographed made mm-hmm. it possible to interpret it another way. So I completely agree that it was an excellent exercise in seeing how people see things differently. But to me, it was clear, like, if you would have, I used to color correct photos for a living, you know, for a regional magazine. And I would, that I would have instantly color corrected. So it would have looked like what it actually was. So I understand that it's a great way to look at how people see things differently, but it was clearly what it was a badly color corrected image of, and anyone who has training in, you know, in color correcting photos and things like that would have said, oh, okay, well, this is clearly, it's got a blue tint and we need to get rid of that. So that's my grumpy old man monkey wrench in that thing.
I still don't think it changes the fact that two people can look at the same image and see different colors. It shows you the sort of bias that our senses actually create, and that we, when people see something, especially something that they're not familiar with,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you were shown that picture knowing what color it was supposed to be, you might not have had the issue.
Right. I just think there are probably better ways of exploring that phenomenon than that particular image.
Yeah, and
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No,
Josh.
I was just gonna say I agree, because I think I had a Facebook status to something of that effect about, like, look, anybody who's done anything like with visual arts gets what's going on here. But at the same time, it's a nice, simple way of explaining some of these concepts, because if you start to talk to somebody about, you know, the idea of co-creating with the phenomena, whatever the phenomena may be, or you start to talk to them about, you know, just perception being flexible, they aren't going to get it. But if you talk to them about the Twitter dress, then they do get it. So I think that's where real value in this comes from, at least from my standpoint.
Yeah. Sure. I get that. I do get that.
You know, I remember reading an article that appeared during that frenzy of the dressgate or the Twitter dress. I think it appeared in the Smithsonian Magazine website that seemed to allude to the fact that in the Iliad or in ancient times, they didn't perceive color the same way that as we do. Like,
yeah,
something
that
that
there was no blue.
Exactly. Yeah, remember
that's,
that?
And that's another one I have a hard time buying
believing
into. Yeah, that people couldn't perceive the color blue.
But it's just like the thing that that Terrence McKenna always used to trot out, is how, like, perspective was discovered. You know, it's just something that we live with day to day. But you look at art, you know, from the time period, and there was definitely somebody had a light bulb moment where suddenly they were able to comprehend that. So I think it falls more into that sort of. I don't think it's that people didn't perceive what we would consider blue. It's just that they might not have realized its significance, or actually have not been processing it the same way that we would, if that makes any sort of sense.
The thing with colors, I always think, is that how do we know we're seeing the same color as someone else? Like, what I see as blue might be red to you. Sure. I mean, we know what it is, but we can't know what the other person is actually perceiving.
Also, yeah, I remember reading the book Heavenly Lights, which deals with the Fatima apparition, you know, which someone like Jacques Vallée will say that is like the one of the most important ufological events in human history.
Yes.
And
yes.
I happen to kind of agree, you know, even the authors agreed. But the authors read the original, like, parochial testimonies that were gathered by the Catholic Church, you know, that they gathered all the witness to the famous Dancing of the Sun that happened on, I think it was October the 13th, 1917, not remember that correctly. But the thing that's interesting is that you see all the different individual testimonies, and people were reporting different colors when particular celestial phenomenon happened. You know, some will say, oh, well, you know, there was like this reddish disc that was dancing in the sky. They will say, no, it was like more like a greenish blue. And they will say, no, it was a silver disc. And they will say, no, it was like something different. And you will say, wait a minute, I mean, what happened here? Why is that all these people were perceiving something fantastical, something phenomenal, but they were all perceiving it differently. And that's why someone like us will start to imagine, you know, maybe if I were to have a UFO sighting, the person next to me will see something completely different. I will see like a disc-shaped craft, and the other person will say, no, it wasn't more like a cigar-shaped, you know? And now, someone would say, oh, yeah, I saw nothing.
Weren't there people in Fatima who saw nothing?
Not
I believe
sure.
There were some people there that saw absolutely nothing going
I
on.
I feel like by sheer numbers, there would have to be somebody there who didn't see anything.
I think most people
I
saw.
I think most even, people saw, yeah,
even
yeah.
Even the atheists who were there specifically to make fun of all the gullible peasants that believed in superstitional nonsense, the moment that they saw that thing, you know, moving out of the sky and almost touching the ground, they were on their knees confessing their sins, you know? Something, and also the idea that there was such a heavy rain before the event, and afterwards, all their people's clothes
were dried,
soaked. You know, it wasn't all just like perception or psychological.
Right. Yeah, there were physical elements to it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to Pluto. And the fact that we finally get to see what Pluto looked like, and it's nothing like astronomers expected, which is pretty much par for the course. They found the Mego that Lovecraft said lived there.
Yes. Thankfully, the fungi from Yuggoth, yes. I was happy to see them there.
But we do have liquid water and blue skies on Pluto. And that's something, of course, they expected it to be a rock with nothing... Yeah. Nothing
it's,
there
it's
at all.
It's a very active world.
But not a plant.
You know, it was a planet once. They should have just left it.
You know, it sort of strikes me, the fact that it was what we were not expecting, makes me wonder how many other things we've overlooked, you know?
Oh, yeah.
That's the first thing that springs to mind.
And of course, one of the comments is, you know, with this having a blue sky but maybe not being primed for life, how many planets out there are we seeing that look like they might be primed for life but are something else entirely?
It's a great question.
Yeah, it's.
And then again, we talk about life as being us essentially.
Well,
as far as I'm concerned, there could be life on Jupiter, but.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? I think it's also. I mean, you know, it's. You know, we frequently chastise, you know, mainstream scientists and things, I think for good reason. But it's also, I mean, that is a beautiful example of what what science can do. I mean, we sent a you know, a probe out to Pluto and got pictures of incredible resolution. And I know some people involved with that project, and you know, I can just imagine what it was like to have spent, you know, years of your life, you know, making this tiny little thing get all the way out there, then to get these enormous high resolution photos that completely dumbfound you as far as what you were expecting to see. How cool.
Well,
you know,
the sad thing is that it only dumbfound a small percentage of the population, because, you know, the large majority really didn't give a crap about, you know, oh, we sent a spacecraft. Never. Who cares, you know? When does the next iPhone is released?
Yeah.
Although,
sadly enough.
You know, Michael, that occurs to me, you're talking about, because, yeah, I'm usually one of the first people to criticize science. But, yes, it felt like real science, because it was approached with openness, a sense of wonder, a sense of exploration, and, you know, a sense of accepting the data, even in the face of challenging preconceived notions. It was not something that was, you know, dogmatic. You know, it wasn't throwing out data that didn't fit an existing model. It was the best of what science can be in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. Yep.
I always wanted to see Pluto. That was the planet I was always the most curious about, and I'm glad it's not just a dead rock.
Well, now it's nowhere but down for you, sir. I am sorry.
Exactly. I'm done. So let's look at a weird one, and that's the Bearstain Bears.
Oh, yeah.
And this popped up, and I'm looking for the term for this, because there's actually a term where people remember things differently from what they are.
The Mandela effect, is that it?
That's it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a personal story about this, and I worked for a public television station, Maryland Public Television, in the 1990s. As a matter of fact, that's up through late 1990s through, I think, about 2002 or 3 or something like that. And I remember, because part of my job was every once in a while I'd go through the listings that they would put out, and I'd look for typos, because I have an eagle eye for typos, except for my own. And I remember looking over the listing of the shows, the kid shows, and I thought, Bearstain Bears, you know, STAIN, that has to be wrong. And I went and checked, and I went, no, it's actually, because I thought, well, it has to be Bearstain, you know, I mean, that's the only thing that makes sense. And so, you know, years before this popped up, I had this experience, and I really do think it's only because we're so used to seeing the word Stein, you know, spelled STEIN, that, and plus you think stain, you know, stain's just kind of like a gross word, you know, you don't want to have a kid show like, you know, the Stains, you know, that's just kind of grotesque. Mm-hmm. But you know, this hit me a lot earlier. So when I saw this pop up, I'm like, wait a minute, man. You know, I've already been there. And it is a great example of how we just see something and project onto it. You know, I would love to believe that it's because of some weird time slip, you know, caused by these children's books that changed everything. But it really is a great, it's a great illustration of just, you know, we're so used to having a particular pattern, and when something breaks that pattern, it just completely doesn't register at all.
I agree, but at the same time, it also illustrates, you know, how on the last show we talked about the difference between evidence and proof, and how difficult, I think this illustrates how difficult it will be to prove that you can actually, you know, jump from one side of the multiverse to another, you know. how could you prove such a thing? Huh? What evidence could you gather? You know, and
I think you could go back and, you know, pick up these books when they first came out. You could look at the contract that, you know, the author signed and things like that. So I think that the proof is pretty easy to find. In this case, it's more of a perceptual. It's a great lesson, and our general perception, I think, more so than, you know, any, you know, jump in the multiverse or anything.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree.
100%. But I'm a killjoy. Knight, clearly, that's what Knight to be the killjoy.
Yeah. If we're looking for a completely prosaic explanation, I seem to recall the name Berenstain Stain really only appearing, of course this could be completely wrong, really only appearing in like the cursive script on the front of the books and not really in the regular clear typography inside the books. And if you look at that signature on the front, it's really easy to sort of gloss over and think it's an E instead of an A because the general shape is kind of the same.
Okay.
So I think that might have something to do with it. But I will say that if we did indeed jump dimensions, then maybe this is something that's been around since the contracts were signed. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean we switched in midstream. It was just one little tiny thing. I do think it's just one of those. It's at any rate, it is fascinating that everybody has this moment. It's like, no, it's Berenstain, right? Yeah.
Honestly, I had no opinion. But I think when I looked at it, I thought the same thing Michael did. You don't expect it to be Berenstain. You expect it to be Berenstain.
Right. Like Victor Frankenstein. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Come on.
I mean, is that a Germanic Teutonic suffix to a name that you see sometimes? Stain? I don't really know if I've ever really seen that anywhere.
No, I don't think so. Now, one of the other Mandela effects is when you think someone's dead and then they die and you go, so they weren't dead already? And that's happened many times where I'm like, I could have sworn they were dead.
Yeah.
How are they still alive, you know? Mm-hmm. But that can just be faulty memory, too.
Yeah, I think that what set this apart is that it was like this collective thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's a bunch of collective ones. If you go to the site, I think it's just MandelaEffect.com.
Oh, man.
MandelaEffect.com. Nice. They have a list of all of them.
Mm.
And like, you know, Billy Graham's funeral on TV, it didn't happen as of September 2015. Right. He's still alive, but a lot of people remember it.
Or Donald Trump seeing Muslims cheering when the two towers came down.
Yeah.
You know, insists he saw, which never happened. But
I mean,
you know,
Donald Trump thinks that Paris is in Germany. So
there you go.
And there's weird ones like some Ghost Hunters TV show. Some remember the earliest show name is Taps, not Ghost Hunters. Yes, we know the real-life team is called Taps, and some of their gear has always said that. But I'm guessing that's people misremembering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but Les, can we talk about the 51 or 52 states? Who are these people?
Yeah.
I don't never even met that know person. That one. Wow, I haven't even heard that one.
The extras are usually Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia, neither of which are actually states, obviously.
That's called poor education.
That's called the duh effect.
Star Trek memories, including Chakotay character killed and then returns several episodes later without much explanation. He says, I've talked about this in person with Robert Beltran, who played the character. He showed the version was never written or filmed.
See, to me, some of these, I would almost call this more of a play it again, Sam effect. You know, Bogart never says play it again, Sam in Casablanca. He says play it, Sam. Mm-hmm. And I think it more has to do with the fact that, you know, things just get sort of ingrained in popular culture. I mean, you know, for example, one of these here is Henry VIII's portrait with a turkey leg in his hand. I think that was just probably this pop culture commentary on him being obese that just sort of got lodged in our brains and, you know, stuck in our head.
No.
So, I mean, it's interesting, but I don't think there's anything paranormal about it.
Not necessarily. I mean, have you guys heard or read the short story written by Jorge Luis Borges, Tlonk Ukbar Orbis Tertius?
No.
So this is the idea that, you know, by ingraining or implanting this story or this notion into the collective unconscious or into the mass culture, it somehow manifests itself eventually. So, you know, I mean, like something like by if you manage to make some enough people believe in something, it eventually becomes true. You know, so I think maybe there's something to that. You know, maybe there's something to we have heard about. You know, the idea that of tulpas, you know, thought forms, you know, that
right.
something that it's common knowledge, you know, in our circles. What about a collective tulpa, you know? You know, could it, is sure. something like that possible? And, you know, could it be the reason why we believe such nonsense like, I don't know, you know, religion, you know, or the idea behind, yeah, you know, the idea behind the ancient gods.
All right, let's go off in a completely different direction.
Maybe the Berenstain Bears were ancient gods.
Exactly, where Berenstain is the Anunnaki trying to disguise themselves.
No, they're big and hairy. They're the Nephilim.
Yeah, and, no, the Nephilim.
Nephilim bears.
I'm a Nephilim. Yeah.
I've always preferred Nephilim.
Yeah.
Or it's actually Nephilim, I think, is what it is.
Nephilim.
And it just doesn't sound right to me. I'll go with Nephilim. I mean, it's changed. It was Nephilim, but now it's Nephilim in another universe.
No, that was in the other dimension, Soraya.
So in a more of a pop culture thing, but a big event for this year, the new Star Wars movie came out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Thoughts, everyone?
Yeah, I went into it very skeptical because I as a kind of a Star Trek purist, I basically vomited in my mouth when I watched the J.J. Abrams Star Wars reboot. I recall an interview with him where he said he never got Star Trek, so that made me mad. But I was actually pleasantly surprised, and I enjoyed the new Star Wars. I thought it was fun. It was light. It was a lot of pandering and callbacks to the original series.
Sure.
And to the fans and all that, but you know, whatever. It was a pleasant experience, which I, you know, as a cynical guy, I seldom have, especially with these big tentpole pictures. I thought it was fun, and that's what the original Star Wars was. I mean, I've gone back and I watched the original, you know, Star Wars: The New Hope. With my kids, and they were kind of bored, you know?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and because they've grown up with Harry Potter, you know, they have a different idea of what movies are like, and it really made me understand that, you know, Star Wars it's an okay movie when you look at it from, you know, a perspective now. But back then, it was so different and so exciting and so unlike other movies. And you know, the mythical resonances were fresh. You know, all that Joseph Campbell, you know, hero's quest stuff was very exciting. You know, it hadn't been done to death at that point. So for me, you know, Star Wars was great. Because it was what it was when I was who I was back then. And it's a different experience watching it now. I don't, you know, my kids don't get it. I don't expect them to get it because they're not, things have changed so much. So you know, for this film, it was a nice. And I'm a big critic of, you know, I've ripped Abrams a number of times, you know, for Star Trek and for Lost, for other things. But I think, you know, it was nice fan service. It actually, unlike what he did with Star Trek, I think he actually understood Star Wars and what it was. And I had a smile on my face most of the movie, even when I know I was being, you know, manipulated, you know, in a sort of an old fanboy sort of way. It was fun. That's ultimately, it was fun.
Go ahead. You and I stand on opposite ends of that, because I loved what Abrams did with Star Trek.
Oh God, I'm getting off the. Goodbye.
And Lost is one of my favorite shows of all time.
Oh, Soraya. I can never believe that. I'm sorry.
I felt that Lost had so much Fortiana mixed into it that it was just brilliant.
I haven't finished watching Lost, you know.
Don't.
See, I loved the end. I thought the end was perfect. I know I'm in the minority there, but yeah.
I'm going to join Soraya because I've seen those 14 elements weaved into the story, and I think that Lost is not for everyone.
I loved the show. And no spoilers or anything here, but I remember, you know, as I got deeper into, you know, fourth season, fifth season, I don't know how long it went on. I kept thinking, did it go six? Yeah. I kept thinking, okay, I like this show, but it's not going anywhere. All of these mysteries are not going to be revealed. And then I remember reading an interview with Damon Lindelof and J.J. Abrams. They said, no, we've got this. We've plotted this out. It all leads to something. Mm-hmm. And as I kept engaged and I got closer and closer to the end, I thought, you know what? They're lying. And sure enough, none of it pulled together at the end. And I'm sorry.
See, I thought it did.
No, it didn't. I'm sorry. It's rare that I invest that much time in something before realizing that it's all a big con. That was a little disturbing, the fact that they said they were pulling all the threads together and they were lying. And Lindelof has basically come out since then and said, well, yeah, we, you know, it was the pressure from the studio and we were just kind of making it up as we went along, and we really didn't have any overarching sort of, you know, theory as to where it was going and why. And I'm okay with that. I mean, as a writer, I understand sometimes you just do things because they look cool or they sound cool or something like that. But I felt like I was gypped. And I was strung along under false pretenses that there really was some sort of coherent mythology underlying this show.
See, my view is I didn't want them to explain things.
Exactly.
You know, I liked the mystery. If they had gone and explained all the mysteries, it would have ruined it for me.
I'm with you on that. I'm with you on that. I like having things unexplained. I like things that are just atmospheric. But there was you can't construct a mythology that doesn't have any kind of coherence, and it eventually just wraps out.
Do you guys think that J.J. Abrams was inspired by the mythology of High Brazil in order to create Lost Island?
Well, let's let Josh say what he wants to say.
Yeah, because he's like fuming.
I'm ranted out of there, Josh.
Before I bust a blood vessel, I agree with Michael on the fact. I think the problem that he's trying to articulate, which is a problem that I have, is that in Lost, the central conceit was the mystery. That was the thing that they were always selling. That was the thing that they were always stringing along. And if it was like more of a if the stuff that they didn't explain was more of window dressing, that wouldn't have bothered me so much, you know. Or if there had been a more metaphysical, like the island just does this, you know, this is just what happens, you know. If there had been more of that, then that would have settled with me more. I am going to jump in on Star Wars with an incredibly unpopular opinion. I passed over my link to my old Wikipedia page because I used to be heavily involved with Star Wars. I'd have to estimate. I'm friends with the founding member of Wikipedia, with the founding father rather of Wikipedia. I authored about 300 to 400 different articles, so I feel like I'm kind of in the bag for some of the stuff. I loved all the aesthetics of The Force Awakens. I loved the way that they handled the old characters for the most part. I thought the new characters were great. I felt like all that was excellent. However, I would pose a simple narrative thought experiment to the three of y'all. Imagine in A New Hope if the goal was to destroy the Death Star, and halfway through they find out about Yoda, and they go and hang out with Yoda, and then in the last 5 minutes they resolve blowing up the Death Star. Imagine that, which I think we all agree would be a horrible plot, in reverse, and that's exactly what happens in The Force Awakens. You have this sudden complete shift halfway through, as if two different scripts have been mashed together that just doesn't make sense. One of the big criticisms that came out when Return of the Jedi first came out was that it was creatively bankrupt to do another Death Star. I agreed with that then. I wasn't alive then, but you know, I agreed with that sentiment for that film. And I agree with that sentiment for this film, too. I mean, you might as well name the darn series Death Star Wars. I think that's a horrible... Just give me something, anything more, you know, original than that. I also have some fundamental problems for just like extreme coincidences that aren't accounted for, like the presence of the lightsaber in the base. Are we doing spoilers?
Spoilers. No, let's not do too many spoilers.
Well, there are some other very coincidental things that.
Yes. No, I agree with that.
That really bugged me. And what frustrates me is that I feel like it's one of my favorite internet movie sites has this rallying cry of one draft away, because I all felt like the movie was like literally one draft away from being like just an amazing film. And part of that is just like simple lines to explain some things, just a line here or there that would have helped it feel a little bit less choppy. So where I sort of fall on it was, like I said, I loved all the peripheral stuff. It's a great way to restart the franchise. The aesthetic is completely nailed. I just have a feeling like it felt like there were some plot decisions that just did not jive with me at all.
The quote I liked is George Lucas saying he didn't like it because they gave the fans what they wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, this is why the prequels were crap. All right, let's, you know.
And that he sold it to the white slavers.
Oh, yeah. Yes. But I don't know, I liked it. It didn't blow me away. I actually expected to like it more than I did. But I did enjoy it. Like Michael said, I smiled. It made me happy.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was fun to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was a nostalgia trip, you know? I mean, it really was a nostalgia trip, and he nailed that. He nailed that very well. And I guess, I mean, the difference here is that I was never a huge, blog, you know, Wookiee blog making fan. No, I don't say that disparagingly. I have friends that are mega fans of Star Wars. But to me, it was just like a nice, you know, trip down memory lane. And I didn't think about it that much, but I completely understand how people who've thought about the mythology would find flaws in this film. You know, for me, it was just like putting on an old comfortable shoe, you know? I mean, it was just like, oh, it looks like Star Wars, and oh, the old characters are popping up and all that sort of thing. And it was just like a, you know, very, very basic, simple, fun experience. But I completely understand how those who are, you know, sort of, you know, really attached to the mythology and things would not have the same experience.
One thing that I will say about J.J. Abrams is that he is amazing at shot composition And he is amazing at casting and finding people who are charismatic. I mean, you look at every project that he's been associated with, and there are zero problems that I have with any of his casting. Mm-hmm. Kudos to him on that.
Yeah.
You know, I personally enjoyed it. You know, I think it was kind of like playing it on the safe side. After all, you know, this was a movie that was supposed to generate, you know, a $5 billion industry, you know?
Yeah,
so I guess, yes, there was the obvious pandering to the fanboys. But in my opinion, it was orders of magnitude better than the goddamn prequels.
Oh, yeah. I don't think anyone would disagree with that.
Yeah, and one thing I want to say to Josh, if you didn't see the original movies in the movies, you know, in the movie theaters, it doesn't count, you know, all your Wikipedia.
Ouch.
Han shot first, damn it.
And when you look at those original movies, it goes back to what we were talking about. I don't remember if it was this show or the show before about attention spans and stuff and how we look at things so differently today. Back in 1977, when that came out, it was a very slow-paced movie, but so were a lot of space movies. If you look at 2001, mm-hmm. I mean, that was incredibly slow-paced. Not a lot actually happens in 2001.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You have movies like one I love is Silent Running.
Oh, yeah, I love that. I just rewatched that, as a matter of fact,
And Silent Running has no real action in it. It's a very slow-paced movie. Yeah. It would bomb if they did it today, but at that time, in the 1970s, that was fine. Yeah. That's what we expected.
Yeah. The Force Awakens has only like two action scenes in the whole movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and The Force Awakens is edited within an inch of its life. I mean, there's zero fat on that movie.
And see, I like Star Trek. I like the original Star Trek.
Yeah.
I watched everything after it. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it at the time, but I don't enjoy it looking at it now. Like, I could still watch the original. Mm-hmm. I actually enjoy most of the movies. But when I try to watch any of the other series now, like if I go back and watch an episode of the Next Generation, it just comes across so campy to me. I can't watch it. So I think I liked what Abrams did. I mean, Abrams, it's not a Star Trek movie true to the original, but I think he gave it a shot of life that it's needed for a while.
Oh, you're pushing my button, Soraya.
I actually enjoyed the first Star Trek movie more than the Star Wars movie. Like, when I watched that first one, I got done and went, I want to watch that again.
Oh, God. In Star Wars, I was vomit off my lap.
So what's another story from 2015? Let's
Let's get back to that.
Now we've shown our true geek colors.
Well, staying in media, the X-Files was announced to make its return, which it's coming back this month, January of 2016.
Yeah.
And we'll see what kind of impact that has. I mean, it had a pretty big impact on the world of the paranormal when it came out.
No, more than the world of the paranormal. I think that it dictated the whole zeitgeist of the late 90s. I mean, the idea of the government is lying to you. You know, it's embedded in our culture. It's never going away.
There's another analogy too with Lost, and that I think the X-Files got bogged down in its convoluted mythology, and that's what sort of and that was kind of a problem with that show. It got so convoluted that I think it kind of lost its central premise. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it defined the whole paranoid, conspiratorial worldview of the 90s like nothing else.
And I think both shows suffered from both that and Lost suffered from the same problem, which is they didn't have an end point. They weren't said, you're gonna do five seasons and that's where your story concludes. It's like, just go with it. And it's like, well, what do we do now to stretch everything out if we don't know when it's gonna end?
Well, and here's to put this in a little bit of a fun light, the things that
that the original X-Files series drew on were actually kind of, for the time, pretty deep cuts into lore. I mean, there were MJ-12 references. There were, I think, at least some vague Kecksburg references. And obviously the Area 51 mythos, but they definitely tapped into what was happening in ufology at the time. Mm-hmm. What has happened in the years since that you would like to see them tap into? Anybody?
That's a great question, man.
Thanks.
How about people going to an ayahuasca?
You know that they actually did an ayahuasca episode.
Oh, son of a bitch.
It was a yage. That was what they called it in the episode.
I like the Black Eyed Children.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Who said that? Who said that?
Really, that's me.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
Yeah, that's a real good one.
Yeah, but where does it go? I mean, you know, I feel like the paranormal.
Slenderman,
there you go. But I feel like the paranormal has been kind of stuck in a rut. I mean, someone, I think it was the Anomalist, posted on Twitter a few days ago that, you know, was ufology stuck in a flaccid stage?
That would have been my friend Chris Xavier.
Yeah.
Daily Grail.
And I tweeted back like, no, it's just in its prolonged refractory period. But it's true. I mean, I feel like there's not the same like vitality. There's not the same.
No.
There's not the same like fresh, novel ideas. You know that there used to be. You know, I mean, yeah, you said Slender Man, Black Eyed Children, but even those are sort of, you know, kind of almost on the way out at this point. You know, that's a great question. What are they going to tackle?
Because that's what I've been wondering. It's like, oh, it's so exciting. I can't wait to see what they bring to, what are they going to bring to it? You know, because I think the areas that I find most exciting, areas like altered states of consciousness and what that can mean to the UFO phenomena, are not going to make for good television.
No. I mean, maybe the writers will just, you know, watch a bunch of old Twilight Zones or something and, you know, rework them. Because it really all goes back to the Twilight Zone.
Yeah,
that's true.
Maybe it'll start with people disappearing in the woods mysteriously.
There you go. You know what? I bet that is very possible storyline.
Let's see. And let's keep on media here for a minute. There's the Travis documentary was released.
Yeah.
And that was actually very good. Have you guys
seen it?
I Travis came to Ford Fest in in Baltimore and the director was there. She presented the movie and it was great. It was my first time meeting him. And you know, he really comes across as a stand up, straight up, you know, no nonsense kind of guy. You know, if I didn't already have a lot of confidence in his story, it really cemented that. But I thought the documentary did a terrific job.
It's not for someone who doesn't know the story though.
Okay. Yeah. It's clearly aimed at people who are in the know. That's sure.
Yeah. It kind of jumps into the depth of it and just runs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, wow, this is really interesting. That the thing I found that probably the most appalling was where they were talking about how Philip Klass was offering the one guy all this money to to say that nothing happened. And the guy's like, needed the money, but I couldn't do it.
Yeah, that's very telling.
So, but yeah, I thought that was really good. Apparently the copy I have is not the finished copy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was 100% done when you saw it, Michael.
It looked pretty polished when I saw it. I think it was the final cut.
I thought mine was too, and then Peter said they were working on another cut of it.
Huh.
Because Peter Robbins was heavily involved.
Okay.
With it.
Well, so to jump a little bit, but while we're still in media, another exciting 90s resurgence is Twin Peaks is coming back.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
And maybe, you know, aside from the X-Files, one of the most Fortean
yes,
TV shows and very groundbreaking. I mean, so that's super exciting. You know, that I mean, as far, you know, I mean, talking about Mike Cleland, I mean, that was the first show to link owls. And,
the owls are and not what foes, they seem.
You know, the owls are not what they seem. And, you know, yep. There was an intercepted message picked up from the NSA that, you know, that's where the owls are not what they seem was, you know, came from. And I mean, it just a brilliant show that really changed, you know, television forever.
And was on for far too short.
Far too short, yeah. And it's another example of, you know, the basically, you know, ABC said, okay, we got to call it quits. And they had to quickly wrap up a show that, you know, had probably had a lot more that it could have done.
Yeah, it felt like it was just getting going.
Yeah, and it ended very abruptly and, you know.
Then they did a prequel movie.
Yeah, yeah, Fire Walk With Me, which was great.
No,
it was, but it didn't. It still left you hanging.
Yeah,
at the end
yeah,
of the
yeah.
Series.
Well, I mean, you know, I was bitching about mystery for mystery's sake earlier, but my caveat with that is, you know, David Lynch is the king of mystery for mystery's sake, and I never expect Lynch to lay it all out very clearly. You know, so
true.
So you know, that's where you guys can come back at me for.
No,
my just hating Lost so much.
I must admit that I haven't really watched the Twin Peaks series.
Well,
but
you better get your.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, everybody
down and watch that, pal.
But I already know that David Lynch seems to be the kind of artist that lets their subconscious take the wheel. You know what I mean? Okay. You know,
sure.
That,
yeah.
And maybe that's what. One of the reasons why those kind of artistic endeavors eventually get crushed, you know, by the wheels of I don't know, the business, commerce, you know, ABC saying, yeah, you know, we have to, you know, end up with this series because, you know, it's not making as much money as we wanted to. Obviously, they're analyzing this artistic effort from the left side of the brain, whereas was supposed to be, you know, for the right side of the brain only.
And there are certain shows that clearly they never should have canceled. Twin Peaks is one, Firefly is another. Even if the ratings didn't support it, the fan base was so rabid it eventually would have paid itself off. And I was going to say something else and completely blanked on what it was. It was saying about Twin Peaks, but let's hope they don't screw that up.
Lynch is involved. I mean, Lynch is directing.
Yeah, he was in and out.
He was in and out. He and Mark Frost, you know, were really the masterminds behind it. And you could tell the episodes that Lynch directed because they were so very Lynchian. But he has... Apparently, he has complete, you know, creative control over this. It's going to be a limited, you know, it's going to be a short series. It's not going to be a full length sort of thing. And I'm just thrilled.
Kind of like X-Files.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah. Yep.
Well, and exactly. if 2015 proved anything, it was the highly unlikely probability that long gap sequels brought to you by the original creators could actually be good. Mad Max, Fury Road, and Creed being good examples of that. So it gives me some extra hope for these continued long gap sequels. Because before Mad Max, Fury Road, I can't really think of anything else that was a long gap sequel that was actually of real quality, you know? Indiana Jones, Star Wars, you know, none of it ever really. Blues Brothers 2000.
You know, I didn't mind the fourth Indiana Jones movie. I didn't think it was anywhere near the first three, but I thought overall, if you cut out a couple of the really stupid bits, it was all right.
Agree.
It had some interesting ideas.
I'm sort of an apologist for that film, too. It definitely...
I liked the fact that it wasn't extraterrestrials.
Yeah, that was... Yeah. It was amazing that they actually slid that line. You know, do they come from space?
Space
no, from the spaces between
the
spaces. Into a mainstream film. Yeah, that's crazy. That's great.
I mean, I could have done without him climbing into the refrigerator at the beginning and surviving a nuclear blast. I could have done without them swinging through the trees with the monkeys.
No. I think the guys in Fallout 4, you know, like made a blooper, but or a homage or made
Easter egg.
Eastern egg out of that. You know, there is a place if you find. You can find the refrigerator with the remains of Indiana Jones in the post-apocalyptic wasteland.
But, you know, if you go back and watch those original movies with today's eyes, too, they were pretty cheesy in spots as well.
Yeah, well.
The other thing you notice with television now is back in the 90s, things would get canceled because their ratings weren't high enough. But nowadays, you'll get especially sci-fi shows that are doing great in the ratings, but they cost too much, so they'll dump them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, that's not cool. Because you're like Farscape, I think, was the first casualty of that. Farscape had fantastic ratings, and they canceled it. And, you know, people were like, why would you cancel this? And they're like, it costs too much.
But yet I remember, I mean, I've been reading about the original Star Trek, and it was the same thing there, you know. I mean, they were spending so much money in Columbia, this CBS was just freaking out about how much money was being spent per episode of the show. So I think that's science fiction in general, you know. I mean, it's
true.
It's
true.
Hard to do it on the cheap. And
you can do it a lot easier now.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let's look at some more on this list here. Oh yeah, there's the family that's now are they suing Area 51? I know Area 51 wants to take some of their land.
Yeah, they're taking their mine.
That's what it is. Okay. I heard about this in passing. Can you go into a little more detail about it?
Well, this is a family that has been running that mine for at least 100 years, right? Yeah. So they were there before the United States government decided to find that strip of land and build their secret base, right? And at first the family welcomed the government because they were, you know, good old American patriots, you know, they were doing their duty. They will invite, you know, the Air Force officers for, you know, coffees or breakfast or whatever. And after they the Air Force built that base, things went sour pretty quick, right? Like they will start to conduct experiments or bomb tests, and that will disrupt the business of this family, and eventually their mine stopped being profitable to the point that they will only go to their property on holidays or weekends. But then, you know, as the Air Force started to secure more public land for the Groom Lake testing sites, you know, eventually this family, they literally had to go to a security check in order to visit their own property. And it's kind of a weird story because at one point you say, well, you know, why didn't you quit and sell your property to the Air Force and say, you know, the hell with it? And for some reason these people wouldn't, you know, after the Air Force apparently offered them $5 million for a mine that wasn't really, you know, worth anything by then. You know, for a moment you want to put your tinfoil conspiratory hat and say, well, you know, maybe the mine is like the secret entrance for their underground base, you know, where they keep they keep all the crash flying saucers or something. You know, so it's a weird story, you know. It partly is a story of the injustice of the government, you know, going after citizens, you know, and using all their power to get what they want. And at the same time, it's like, you know, feeling that there's something else that you're not getting. You're not getting the full story of it.
It's an interdimensional vortex in the mind. It's obvious. It's obvious.
Obviously, yeah.
Well, you know, speaking of that, well, there's two things I want to say off of that. One, it's funny that now everyone's just accepts that Area 51 existed, whereas for so many years they'd be denying it, and you'd have people also denying it.
Right.
You know, oh, no, no, the government wouldn't lie to us, and then they come out, oh, yeah, Area 51 exists, and most of us are like, well, yeah. Did you really think it was a secret anymore? But the other thing is, have you guys heard this story about this guy who disappeared in this H-shaped cave?
No.
No what?
Okay. This guy claims he was out in the desert, and I don't remember exactly where. I'm trying to look it up.
New Mexico?
And something like that. New Mexico or something. Yeah. And he claims to have come across an H-shaped cave. It looked like a letter H. And he said the vibrations coming off the cave were so strong, they were making him sick. Mm. And he was going to go back home and come back with like equipment to prove that this thing existed, and he disappeared.
Huh. When was this?
Just within the last few months.
Interesting.
And I'm not finding the article on it, unfortunately. But there was a whole internet thing where they're looking for the guy, because, you know, he was posting YouTube videos of his explorations. Oh. And he was talking about how he found this cave, and it was really weird, and it scared the hell out of him, but he wanted to go back and get, you know, some footage and stuff of it, and that was the last anyone heard of him.
Hmm. Sounds like a viral stunt for a movie.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Although
let's keep an eye on that, and, you know, I mean, it sounds like the perfect setup for, you know, Paranormal Activity 8 or, you know, whatever the series is up to now.
You know, I think, though, it's interesting. I feel like way too much emphasis in ufology is placed on the skies and not enough is placed on the ground, you know, or under the ground, as it were. I mean, I feel like there's still something kind of weird about that, you know?
Okay, I found the article.
Okay.
The search continues for a 47-year-old hiking enthusiast who disappeared somewhere in the deserts of Nevada. Oh. While the Sheep Mountain area has been known to take the lives of even experienced hikers, the missing persons case of Kenny Veach is very particularly peculiar. The self-proclaimed adventurer sought after a mysterious cave he said once evoked a strange, possibly supernatural occurrence within him. He says, One time during one of my hikes out by Nellis Air Force Base, I found a hidden cave. The entrance to the cave was shaped like a perfect capital M. I always enter every cave I find, but as I began to enter this particular cave, my whole body began to vibrate. The closer I got to the cave entrance, the worse the vibrating became. Suddenly, I became very, very scared and hightailed it out of there. That was one of the strangest things that ever happened to me. And so it says, months later, Veach made good on his vow and returned to the spot he remembered seeing the cave, along with a trusty 9mm. A video shows him looking for the cave, but despite a new friend in the form of a smiley tortoise, the trip's pretty much a bust. And then Veach returned to the site a month later to find the cave, this time planning an overnight hike. He was never seen or heard from again. His worried girlfriend comments on the video he posted, explaining that since he left in November, Veach is still missing. She urges future solo hikers to use a GPS while exploring.
Hmm.
So, I mean, that's weird.
Yeah, that qualifies. Yeah.
Maybe related to the story of the family fighting with the U.S. government over their property.
It's definitely an interesting angle, yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll know if they ever find him. You know, if he just succumbed to the elements or had an accident, or if he's just never found again.
I'm sure someone has posted it to David Pilatus' Facebook page. Oh, I'm sure. if anybody is friends with him or follows him on Facebook, that's always entertaining to watch how many people will just post anybody missing on his Facebook page. Yeah.
that's because people don't understand that he's looking for certain criteria, not just everyone who disappears weirdly.
Exactly. Yep.
Now, Red Pill Junkie, you wrote on here there's a Betty and Barney Hill movie?
Mm-hmm. Apparently, some movie studio decided to opt the rights for the book Captured, co-written by Kathleen Mardenne and Stanton Friedman, which deals with the story of, possibly the most famous alien abductees in the world, Betty and Barney Hill back in 1961, if I'm not mistaken. And apparently someone is going to make a movie out of them. And it's interesting because, it won't be the first movie based on that particular story.
Yeah, there was a TV movie made.
Yeah.
The UFO
incident. Yeah, well, apparently there's James Earl Jones.
Yeah, and Bryce Zabel is writing this screenplay, I think.
Yeah, I'd heard that.
Yeah.
Which should
The original one was 1975.
75, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And James Earl Jones, has a fantastic performance in that movie.
It was great. Yeah, it was really, really good. Yeah.
Yeah, the part hopefully... when he is... Yeah, sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, hopefully Bryce's involvement will ensure some degree of fidelity to the actual facts.
Yeah, I hope so.
So I didn't even know that was being made. That's really cool.
Yeah, speaking of which, this year there was this podcast interview with the granddaughter of Barney Hill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah, Angela Overkill, I think, is his name in the UFC. He's a UFC fighter, and she discussed the story of her grandfather, not in great detail. I mean, it was more about her feelings about the story, how she tackled with that kind of quote-unquote fame when she was in college or high school or whatever, my grandfather has a Wikipedia entry, and supposedly my father believed that he was abducted by aliens. And there was also the hint that he had been, dishonorably discharged for the army due to mental issues, which would have been like a Section 8 discharge. But that doesn't seem to be the case at all, because apparently, as far as I have been able to uncover, Barney was honorably discharged from the army after World War II. Mm-hmm. And, there's this idea that, that maybe she seemed to allude was that he had mental issues and he ended up marrying this woman who already was on the fringe, being Betty Hill, and so she finally managed to bring him to the edge. And I feel it's that was kind of like unfair. Obviously, after the event became worldwide known, even Kathleen Mardens admits that Betty's judgment became quite lax. That every light in the sky would be a UFO for in her mind. But from there to dismiss the whole story of what happened to them in that secluded place near New Hampshire in 1961, I feel is still a long stretch.
Hmm. Now, I don't remember. Did they have other UFO experiences, or was that the only one?
Yeah, they did have other strange experiences, something that... I think that they even try to manifest actual contact.
Yeah.
And Jacques Vallée was involved in that.
Mm-hmm. And Betty had precognition of car accidents from friends and all sorts of stuff like that throughout her entire life.
Mm-hmm. No, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. See, and what strikes me about Travis's encounter is Travis's was a one-off encounter.
So he says.
Yeah. But I think you have two different types of things going on. You have the people who have the experiences their whole lives, and then you have the people who maybe are in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm. You think that is possible with something like the UFO phenomenon? Like that, that it's a matter of chance, of random?
I'm not sure about that. It
generally seems pretty planned out.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah. And I think, people who have, whether or not they're just projecting or confabulating, people that have especially contact experiences, most of them wind up thinking, then there was this time when I was a kid, and we talk to people, it's among a lot of the researchers, they'll say, maybe it was Bud Hopkins or something, that maybe it was an exaggeration. I might not go that far, but he basically said anyone who's seen a UFO has probably had some sort of, personal contact.
That was Mike Cleland who.
But even before I knew of Cleland, this was years before I even knew who Cleland was. I remember hearing that among, sort of the people who were into, looking at abductions and mm-hmm. things like that. So I think it predates Cleland. Maybe Cleland picked it up.
Yeah, sure.
From someone.
Okay. Let's go back into ancient cultures. And there's this article you sent along. A 12-meter long monolith found off the Sicilian coast is at least 9,000 years old.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And that's huge.
That's huge in all so many respects. Graham Hancock keeps writing. Stuff keeps getting older, and we keep finding more and more evidence that our history is buried beneath the waters, and mm-hmm. we just need to keep looking for it. But mm-hmm. unfortunately, except for a few occasions, we aren't.
Mm-hmm. No, it's generally by chance. I mean, mm-hmm. I remember there was also article about a pyramid structure being found by the Canary Islands.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard anything followed up on that, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think there was an article that happened in 2014. A pyramid structure that was found near the Azores Islands near Portugal.
I remember that,
And Graham Hancock, think that investigated, but I knew nothing further about it.
Yeah, well, I think part of the problem is with a lot of the scientific establishment is there's no money in finding these things. You're not going to get a grant to go out and spend all the money that you need to investigate something far below the surface of the water. Money is tight in the sciences, and it's all grant driven. There's very little that goes to pure investigation, much less looking into something that is going to upset the apple cart and make you look like a crank even for suggesting so. I think that's the real problem. As much as it is, a lot of people believe, they're covering this stuff up, and I think there are a lot easier explanations, a lot more likely explanations. Just there's no incentive to do this kind of research. You know, what? There's no money in it. If there's no money in it, unless unless suddenly Bill Gates, you know, takes an interest in sunken, you know, antediluvian civilizations, you know, people aren't just going to go out and be able to find this stuff or follow up on it.
And I think
No, I was just going to say, so it's, you know, it doesn't have to be that, it doesn't have to be this, you know, this coterie of, you know, this conspiracy of establishment scientists who just want to, you know, keep their reputations intact. It's just a matter of, there's just no stimulus to go out and look into this stuff.
Yeah. And I think there might be an international component as well. You know, on a lot of different countries, this sort of thing isn't their priority. You know, you look at a lot of the places where some of these things have been found, and they have much bigger issues. You know, I mean, it's amazing that we have any archaeological stuff going on in the U.S. with all the stuff that we've got to draw our attention. But I think that's a component too.
Yep.
Well, and you got to consider, too, a lot of these cultures, you know, like Egypt's a perfect example. They don't want this stuff to be too old, because if it comes out of the current Egyptian culture, it's no longer theirs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's that sort of pride thing. You know, we built the pyramids. Well, they probably did. But an ancient culture may have laid them out to begin with and may have given them the knowledge on how to build these pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
And they may not have built the Sphinx, but they don't want to hear that because, you know, you don't want to take that out of the Egyptian culture.
Sure.
Because if it's 10,000 years old, Egyptians didn't build it because there wasn't a Egypt there at the time.
Yep.
Yeah, and who is this "we built the pyramids" idea? I mean, the people who live in Egypt nowadays are the result of subsequent invasions of Romans and Greeks and Arabs that happened thousands of years after the pyramids were laid out. I mean, I'm no different. You know, I have a kind of irrational pride out of the fact of speaking about, you know, Teotihuacan and all the ruins that are in my country, even though I know that I'm the product of, you know, European invaders. Hundreds of years after those cities were built, you know, I mean.
All right, so that was part two of the year in review for 2015. And next week we'll be doing another midweek podcast to cover the rest of the stories that Red Pill Junkie has collected that happened over the last year.